Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, coming to you from Boston, where we are hours away from, well, the biggest game of the season. That's not hyperbole. Game 4 of the finals is tonight. Celtics have a chance to go up 3-1 and put a stranglehold on this series. Warriors, of course, need a win to tie this thing and make it a best of three. Steph Curry's health is a question mark as I record this. We will touch on all of that with our guest today, the Hall of Famer Grant Hill. We will discuss the finals, of course, but mostly we will chat up with Grant about his new autobiography. It's called Game. It is out now, available at all the usual places. I highly recommend it. You'll learn a lot about Grant's life and his career, including a lot of new details about the ordeals he went through with his ankle, all the surgeries that permanently altered his career. He shares a lot of new details and just really decides to be very candid and about the toughest moments of his career in a way that I don't think he ever has before. So check out the book, Game. It's fantastic. We discuss that at length as well. Before we get to all that, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Grant Hill is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to welcome back to the pod, two-time guest now, Hall of Famer, and now author of the book Game, Grant Hill. Grant, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Two-time guest. All right, that means I'm in good standing with you. That's a good thing.
You only need like three more punches on the punch card for a free cup of coffee. That's how this works. appreciate you coming back on. We're going to jump in on the book, which was great. But before we get to that, we are talking the morning of game four. I'm in Boston. You are not, although you were around for games one and two in San Francisco. And I know you're back for five, and we'll see if there's a six and seven, and you're back for those two if those happen. What is your read of the series as we sit here now? The Warriors shoot around will be in another couple hours. I'll be going over there. Who knows what Steph's status is at this point? He says he'll play. They're obviously down. They looked totally outclassed, outmuscled the other night. What's your read of the series right now with the Celtics up 2-1?
Well, you know, first of all, Golden State has to be kicking themselves that they lost that first game. And, you know, you know, the first two games, you know, pretty much seven of those eight quarters, you know, Golden State, for the most part, won. I mean, You know, they had, you know, sensational third quarters in both those games. But now it's, you know, now it's do or die. You know, like you cannot go back game five down 3-1 if you're Golden State. You know, I think Boston has shown that, you know, that they're for real. Obviously, we knew that going in. They're tough. They're capable. You know, they're long, physical. They're great defensively. This Golden State team, and this is, I mean this, you know, and I say this respectfully, but it's probably the least talented finals team they've had. But I think everyone has been expecting them to win because of that institutional knowledge they have. I thought, you know, game two, obviously, defensively, they forced turnovers. That was really the big difference. You know, I think 19 turnovers led to 33 points. Boston valued the basketball better in game three. The complementary players played well, particularly Marcus Smart, which he didn't do in game two on the offensive end. You know, Golden State's got to get back to being disruptive defensively, and they can't afford to dig a hole like they did in game three. So a couple things. I actually think Golden State's going to come out and play better. You know, we forget this is a team that was blown out by 50 in Memphis, you know, a few series ago. And so most teams, you lose by 50. It takes a few games to mentally and emotionally recover from that embarrassment. So I expect that they'll come out, they'll be better. You know, it'll be interesting to see with Boston. Boston has been up and down in the postseason at home. And so I'm not entirely sure why that's the case. The Milwaukee series, the Miami series, they gave up some critical games at home. Of course, they went out and won some, you know, games on the road. But I think it's up in the air. Like, I know I'm supposed to sort of, you know, predict sometimes who's going to win, but I could really see it go either way. And I think Golden State has a great performance. Klay and Steph both played well in game three. Yeah. You know, Draymond didn't shoot and score well. He acknowledged that. But I think he's got to have an impact. He's got to have an impact on the game like he did in game two. Defensively, causing turnovers, being a disruptor and agitator. And he's got to get some points, you know, some, you know, fake dribble handoffs, things in transition. He's got to, you know, fill up the stat sheet a little bit better than he did in game three.
So you mentioned Draymond and your colleague at Turner, Isaiah Thomas, said after the game the other night, he thinks that the focus for Draymond isn't there because of the podcasts that he's doing after games and because of him getting into this whole, you know, back and forth with the crowd to an extent. And I don't know, it's more the crowd toward Draymond than it was Draymond to the crowd, but a lot of just this other stuff that's going on. Isaiah felt like that was draining Draymond's focus. And I've always looked at Draymond the other way, Grant, which is that, you know, he's fueled by a lot of that stuff and it's all part of kind of his makeup, his mental game, his attitude, that ferocity he brings to the court, that edge he brings to the court. So it was interesting to hear Isaiah say that. Like, and so I'm just curious your perspective on that, because Isaiah's speaking from experience, clearly as someone who played the game at a high level a long time as you did. Is it possible that these other things are somehow distracting Draymond on some level?
Well, first of all, I'll say this. Isaiah and Draymond have both won multiple championships. I didn't, so I want to at least give that perspective. Well. But, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think if you look at things through the lens of Isaiah and sort of his time and who he is as a player and what he needed to do to maybe get himself focused, then, yes, I can understand where he's coming from. I can understand it, too, from my standpoint. I mean, I don't know if I would be at my best if I, you know, decompressed the way that Draymond is decompressing. But this is who he is. And this is kind of the generation of players. You know, they've come up with, you know, social media, technology. They're just very different. And I don't say that good or bad. I'm just acknowledging the reality. So I don't think at all. I think this is actually healthy. And I think for Draymond to be able to talk, to vent, to offer perspective, I mean, a lot of times you're doing that with the media during the media obligations. And so, I mean, I think this is, we all sort of, you know, process, prepare, you know, decompress, whatever you want to call it, we all do that differently. And I think this is right on brand, but also just par for the course, excuse my golf analogy, for Draymond in terms of who he is and how he best responds and prepares.
It's interesting, Grant. Now, we'll wrap up on the finals on this one, but just like the criticism of Draymond for podcasting, and Isaiah's not the only one who said it, but it kind of almost makes sense. I know you know, you and Isaiah, not quite the same era, and so maybe that's part of this, but your era, I always think of as that's a time when Shaq comes in. Shaq's doing commercials and movies before he's even played in the NBA, I think. And then he does rap albums. And the whole thing was, Shaq should be working on his free throws instead of making rap albums. Shaq should be working on his free throws. Like, as if these things were mutually exclusive. Like, you couldn't possibly do both. And I also can attest, having covered Shaq for 7 years, that he could have quit everything else and he still wouldn't have made his damn free throws. Like, he tried. He practiced the free throws, folks. He just couldn't make them. It didn't matter. But today's NBA, Grant, like, guys are, they're podcasting, they are investing in crypto and NFTs, they are doing all kinds of side projects, they're getting into wine, they're doing, and nobody thinks twice about it for the most part, because this is an era where it's just kind of accepted that guys can multitask, and it's not necessarily detracting from your basketball. It seems like Isaiah's view of this is still kind of rooted in, you know, 80s and 90s, when it was like, this is the only thing you should be doing.
Yeah, I think you have a point. And, you know, I want to say that when Michael Jordan emerged and became not just a media darling, but a pitchman, and, you know, sort of the mid to late 80s with Air Jordan and McDonald's and Coca-Cola and everything else, you know, I think there were folks who felt that that was a distraction. And that was, you know, at least, until he won. And so you look now, you fast forward, you know, forget about Draymond, look at LeBron. I mean, LeBron's a mogul, you know, yeah. I mean, LeBron is, I just watched one of the movies at his entertainment company with Adam Sandler and Kenny Smith.
I heard that was good.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good movie. And, but I mean, LeBron is someone who I think is celebrated for, you know, more than an athlete, and for all of the ventures and activations, engagements, speaking out, social justice. I mean, all these things now that, you know, 40, 50 years ago, athletes weren't really doing. And so I just think it's part of the evolution. We talk about the evolution of the game and three-point shooting and the skill and all these things, but also the evolution of an athlete. And I think LeBron exemplifies that. You got C.J. McCollum has podcasts. You know, J.J. Redick had a podcast that's very popular, and you know, while he was playing, and now he's retired. So, I mean, it's a different game. It's a different world. And it's, you know, and so I don't have an issue with it. Yeah. I see where Isaiah's coming from his late 80s, early 90s perspective. But nowadays, things are a little bit different.
Yeah. No, and I think it's a healthy evolution that from the public standpoint and from the player standpoint, they can avail themselves of all these opportunities. And I think we are, generally speaking, as the public, fans, media, less judgmental of it, or actually don't even think twice about it. It is the norm now, and it always should have been. They always should have been able to pursue those things. All right, so the book. Let's talk about the book. Congrats on the book. Again, it's The Game, an autobiography. You go into a lot in depth here, Grant, and you just expose yourself on many levels, just in terms of the things you went through, the most excruciating parts of your career, and not just people, obviously they know well the injuries and the surgeries that you went through, but you talk about racism, about law enforcement, about a lot of things that I think, you know, maybe you addressed in passing in the course of your career, or maybe not. I don't recall these things being that you went into that kind of detail. You're 9 years removed from retirement, so maybe this is a time when it's you've got the perspective and just the distance from it. But I'm curious about deciding to do this now, you know, reviewing everything that went on with your ankle, with, you know, surgeries and botched diagnoses and borderline or actual malpractice, possibly a near-death experience. Why now? And what was it like to kind of decide to go through this process of putting it all on paper?
Yeah, you know, a couple things. I do think, in 2018, you know, I was fortunate to go into the Hall of Fame and be enshrined. And you know, the announcement occurs at the Final Four, and then you have a few months of lead up, you know, till September. And, you know, that's a celebratory time. And that's a time where you should be, you know, I've heard people say that regardless of what happened or didn't happen during your career, you go into the Hall of Fame, it kind of just makes it all right, you know, and, but the lead up and the time to naturally be reflective kind of had me like torn a little bit. And I was appreciative, I was excited, but I was also mad and probably even a little bitter because, you know, I realized, look, I got in because of my 4 years in college and what I accomplished there. And then the 6 years, you know, in the NBA for the most part. So that 10-year body of work. But like I was on this trajectory that I didn't get a chance to see all the way through. And I'm like, man, like I had an incomplete and I'm getting in the hall. Like, imagine if we could have seen this all the way through. And so that, you know, for me, I don't like to look back. I don't have, you know, memorabilia. I used to always say, you know, if you came into my house, you would never know that an NBA athlete lived there, except for the size of my shoes all over the house. But I didn't put up memorabilia. I didn't put up awards. I always felt like I needed to continue to pursue and continue to like stay hungry. And so, you know, I didn't look back and over the good and the bad. And so that, you know, that moment sort of, I decided, okay, I want to do this. And, you know, it took me a minute. That was 18. And a lot of things happened like COVID. And, you know, I had another surgery in 19. I had a lung infection that knocked me out for 4 or 5 months in 19. But I eventually got to it. And here we are now. And, you know, to be vulnerable, to be introspective, to be honest, you know, and a lot of those themes that you mentioned that I touched on, I mean, these are just things that I experienced, yeah. You know, things that happened throughout the course of the journey. And some of it's sort of behind the scenes of Duke, and some of it's getting into my insecurities and things I dealt with during my formative years and even during my time at Duke, you know, managing celebrity, going through the challenges of being the face of a franchise and some turmoil at times there. And the injury ordeal, which I think everybody who is old enough to remember was aware of, but I don't know if they understood the complexities and the depth of what exactly happened. So, you know, just sharing and being honest and, you know, taking down that armor, that, you know, that facade that we put up as athletes and trying to be just real. It was liberating. It was, you know, therapeutic. It was frightening. You know, it was a lot of things to be able to do that. But ultimately, I'm glad that I did and glad with the end result.
You co-wrote this with my good buddy, Jonathan Abrams. He was along. So I cannot imagine, because there's a lot in this book. I cannot imagine. Tell me a little bit about the process there, about having, you know, you're working with somebody on this, right? It is your story. He's there to help, you know, shape and tease out things, whatever. I don't know how often, like, you're coming to some point where it's like, okay, I've told that story. And then, like, because we're reporters, we're going to say, yeah, but okay, but what about what this one thread or this other thread? What was the process like of just kind of like, not just airing it out from your own memory, but having somebody else there to kind of like pull those threads, decide where it's leading?
You know, it was great. I mean, it was interesting because, first of all, I'm naturally long-winded, so I guess I like to hear myself talk. But, you know, he would tee me up with a question, and I would go. And sometimes, you know, it might be, okay, you arrive on campus your freshman year. Let's go there. And I would just start talking about, you know, the first practice, talking about, you know, moving into the dorms, talking about, and I might all of a sudden pivot to my senior year. Like, you know, so I was all over the map. Poor Jonathan having to sort of construct all this and put it together. But, you know, I think, first of all, it was a great process, and he made it easy. He was able to really kind of write and sort of speak in my words and sort of from my perspective, if you will. You know, I wanted somebody who I think was familiar with sport, and kind of knew me, and also someone who understood, you know, Jonathan's a person of color, and so I think understands some of those issues that we deal with. But then also somebody I didn't know that well, you know, and someone who, you know, he may come in with his own sort of biases or you know, perspective, but and then also spending a lot of time together. Like, to me, we spend a we left some material on the edit room floor. I mean, we spent a lot of time, and you know, and it wasn't all in person. A lot of it was on the phone. Mm-hmm. And so the more time one can give, I think it gives people such as yourself, you know, just the best opportunity to put together the story correctly. And, but yeah, I mean, we met a little bit in person, but a lot of it was over the phone in 2-3 hour increments. And, you know, I'd say, I don't know. I mean, I'm estimating here, it might have been 300-400 hours. So maybe, I mean, I don't know. It was a lot.
Wow.
And so I'm sure he's tired of hearing my story. but he was great. I mean, and being able to pull certain things out, I think, you know, being a journalist, and then also knowing what's interesting and knowing what translates. I mean, this is my life. Some of the stuff I thought was kind of like boring or no one would care about. And he's like, no, let's go a little deeper. Hmm. And so I think having a writer, having someone who does this for a living really helped, I think, frame the story and tell the story in a very accurate but also interesting and fascinating way.
And by the way, like, you guys clearly worked together very well, Grant, because I feel like your voice, your story in your voice comes through very clearly here. Like, you wouldn't, you know, I think that's probably the goal, right? It should be kind of a seamless thing between author and co-author if you're using somebody, you know, an outside writer to shape. But it's seamless. So the two of you together, the partnership seemed to very much work very well, came through very well. One of the most compelling parts of this, of course, is you going into detail that I know you've talked about at times with the injury, with the four surgeries, but you really, you know, go deep on it here, and you really are very candid about your feelings about the team doctor in Orlando and about where things went awry and your feelings on that. How difficult was it to go down that road and to this level? Because it sounds a little tense, and these are things that you probably have avoided on some level for a while too, still being associated with the league or while you were still in your playing days. How difficult to decide to actually jump into all of that in that kind of detail?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think when all this was happening in real time, no one had any idea. You know, the story never really was told, and I think people may have jumped to their conclusions. Okay, he's fragile, he can't get healthy, whatever. The medical staff wasn't good, whatever people might have thought. But I always felt like they have no idea, like, what's going on here. And so, you know, as I got healthy and was in Phoenix, towards the end of my career, you know, a couple times I might do an interview. I might have done an interview with you, or, you know, I've done a radio interview. And a couple times I've touched on some things, but it never was like the full totality of what happened. And so I just always said, you know what, like, at some point I got to do a book or a documentary, like, to really kind of explain, not thinking that I ever really would. But when I committed to this process, first of all, I didn't realize how much all of that still affected me. Hmm. And as I said, I didn't, you know, when people go through something traumatic, and certainly there are those who've gone through far worse than that. Look, I was still an NBA player. I was, you know, beautiful wife, family. I mean, you know, so I want to, you know, keep it all in perspective, but that was traumatic for me. And, you know, people suppress. If the doctors say, okay, you got to be on crutches again for 4 months, then I'm like, okay, I'm going to have strong arms. You know, like I'm just like, I'm attacking it. I'm an athlete, you know, okay. What do I have to do? And so I didn't allow myself to mentally or emotionally unpack what was happening in real time. Yeah. And then ironically, not until 20 years later, as I'm retelling this and I'm, you know, it's like I'm talking to a therapist as I'm talking to Jonathan, although he's not giving me anything back in return. But, you know, as I'm walking him through what happened and I'm reliving and he's asking, like, how did you feel? What was it? You know, he's asking questions that are forcing you to go deeper. I realize that, like, wow, I haven't dealt with that. And it's, you know, I haven't, you know, emotionally, I dealt with it physically, you know, but I didn't deal with it, you know, mentally and emotionally. And as I told the story, we finished the book. And as you know, you finish a book and you have 9 months before the book's released. So, you know, you live with it. You might read it from time to time. You know, I did the voiceovers for the audio version of the book.
Oh, nice.
It's very interesting when you read the book out loud, but you're living with it. And I also realized that, and this was after we finished the book, that void of not finishing my career, that sort of, like I said, being on this trajectory and then being derailed, like that void, it, I think, has led me to obsessively pursue achievements and accomplishments in retirement. And to the point where, like, I'm so out of balance and I have too much on my plate. But I was so driven in retirement. And, you know, the mistakes I've made, and this is not really in the book, but the mistakes I've made is I've tried to do everything. And I have a problem saying no, but but just wanting to do everything. And so when you go through and you reflect and you tell your story, like, you sort of self-analyze a little bit yourself. And like, my fault right now is not having the proper balance, I think, in my life. And where does that stem from? I think a lot of it, you know, that void and that trauma that I went through in the early, you know, early 2000s. And so I'm kind of dealing with that and processing that now, 20 years later, as opposed to when it was all going down back in the day.
That's really interesting. So the four surgeries directly lead to you running USA Basketball, is what you're telling me.
No, that's a good thing. That is a good thing. That is something that I am really thrilled and really excited about. So thrilled that I'll do it for free.
There you go. Well, you've got that. You've got, obviously, you're very active in your ownership stake with the Atlanta Hawks, and I'm sure, like, probably 50 other things that I'm not even aware of. But I don't know. I tend to think that guys like you, Grant, who are driven at the highest level as athletes or in a lot of professions, like there's that you can't shut it off anyway. And I'm sure you're right. Your self-analysis, I'm sure, is correct that, like, there is some part of that that's the void that you referred to. But I tend to think that people who are just hyper-driven, like, can't sit still anyway.
There's truth to that. Look, my parents, I mean, my mom, you know, my dad, I mean, they're, yes. So I get it innocently, but it sounds good to tie it to the story.
I like it. No, it's a good theory. It's probably true. Is there any, sounds like such a cheesy, like, almost, you know, armchair psychologist thing to say, but is there closure that you get from finally putting all this on paper, especially about, as you say, that trauma of those surgeries, of your near-death experience from an infection? And people, again, read the book because the details and all that are fascinating and frightening. And you'll get a much better sense of it from the book, so I don't want to give it all away here. But is there any closure, Grant, in just putting it on paper, putting it out there, naming names with doctors and everything else? Feel any? I don't want to say better about it, but is there closure?
Well, first of all, let me just say I didn't want to write what happened there from a point of bitterness. Like, I wanted to, like, tell what was happening, share what I was feeling, or at least what I thought I was feeling in that moment, and just sort of walk the reader through all of it, and so they can experience and understand exactly what happened. I think in terms of medically all that happened, yes, I think I'm good with that. I'm healthy now. Yeah, I have an arthritic ankle. I have a nasty scar. You know, I can't play basketball, but I can play golf. Not well, but I can play. and I'm alive, you know, and so I, you know, yes. The thing, though, that I don't know if I'll ever get over is just not being able to have played. And the game was like at a point where, you know, the game, like, you know, I started working with Chip England, and, you know, I really was like working hard in the off season and looking to improve on areas. And I just felt like the game was like at a point where it was easy. And that sounds super arrogant, but like, I felt like I figured it out. And I think I had a window, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years sort of into, they call that the prime years. I don't know, 26 to 32, 33. And I never got a chance to go there. Now I'm grateful that I had a chance to come back and play, and I had a 6-year run, but I don't know if I'll ever get over that. Like I'm being perfectly honest. I mean, I hope I get over it, but I don't know if I'll ever get over, you know, just not, you know, the one thing that like validates you, the thing that you're one of the best in the world at in doing, and the thing that I poured so much of my life into, and, you know, yeah, I was given some God-given abilities, but I also worked my tail off, and like just not being able to, you know, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't know if I'll ever get over that, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, understandably. But to remind people, your first six seasons in the league before the ankle, 5 times All-NBA in your first 6 seasons. I think like that says it all about where you were and what your trajectory was, averaging 21.6, 8 rebounds and 6 assists. And you were one of those guys, Grant, and we talked about this years ago for a story I did. You were one of those next Jordans. You were in that list of guys like, oh, who's going to be the next Michael? It's Grant Hill. And that was like everybody took their turn there for a while. But you actually had a chance. You know, there is no next Jordan, of course, as we've all just, you know, concluded and discussed ad nauseum. But your trajectory was going to be very, very high regardless. So people should remind when you're talking to, I don't know if it's to your own kids or to younger people now who didn't see those 6 years, or maybe they only know the unfortunate tortured later stages of the career. How do you describe that 6-year run to them?
Well, you know, it's funny when I was in Phoenix towards the end of my career, and certainly in a role player, complementary player role, you know, every once in a while, my oldest daughter, who's now 20, you know, she would go on YouTube and find old footage and highlights of me in Detroit. And she'd say, Dad, come here. Like, man, you weren't always a scrub. And so, you know, I...
Gotta love having our kids there to keep us humble.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, it's funny. I don't think, you know, it's interesting. I don't think that when people would come to me and say, hey, oh man, when I saw you in Detroit, or, oh, you know, if you hadn't got hurt, or what if, like, oh, man, you're the ultimate what if. I never really like saw that. And what I mean is, you know, when I played, like I didn't get to the mountaintop in Detroit. I didn't win, you know, all that stuff, all NBA, all stars, commercials, shoot, like, that was fun, and you know, I leveraged that, and that was great. But like, to me, it was about winning, and we weren't able to win, and I took that hard, and I blamed myself, and was hard on myself for not being able to get to that level. And so, once again, like I suppressed a lot of that, and I didn't, you know. So going through the book, like I got a greater appreciation for how good I was, you know, and when people would say stuff to me, when I looked back on my career, I saw me out here, you know, with a bad ankle, trying to guard Carmelo, you know, in Phoenix. Like I, you know, the fight that as you get older and you have injuries and all, like, that's what I saw. And so to go back and reflect and go on YouTube and look at some games, and, you know, just to live in those moments, like I had to almost remind myself. And so celebrating, you know, like one of the things I told in an interview the other day was like learning to celebrate your accomplishments when they happen, you know, because I didn't celebrate. I was I don't want to say miserable, and I don't want people to think that I was miserable because I was in Detroit. I was miserable because we weren't winning.
Yeah.
And at Duke, you know, we won. And so I got a taste of what that's like. And I didn't care about my, you know, individual stuff. You know, I deferred to Leitner. I mean, I you know, and it was about winning. And we couldn't get it done. And I blamed myself. So I didn't give myself permission to enjoy those moments. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
no,
but
it totally does.
So, like I said, you know, to be able to like go back now and say, "Oh man, I was kind of dope. Like I was pretty good." You know, it was a good exercise for that too.
It's nice that we have YouTube around for so that the kids can see these things. So, folks, if you missed Grant live at the time, if you were not watching the NBA because you weren't around, go look him up on YouTube. He was pretty good. Before I let you go, I'd be remiss if I didn't at least touch on one of your many, many other pursuits, the Hawks. Obviously a difficult, you know, kind of a come down from that conference finals run a year ago. This happens sometimes with young teams, but you know, both Travis Schlenk and Steve Koonin, I think more recently, have said it, various versions of, it was a mistake for us to just kind of run it back with the same group, to not, whether it was the last offseason, or I think Travis had talked about it being about last offseason. Steve Koonin more recently, I think, said something about, you know, we had deals on the table at the trade deadline that we could have made, and now I think we should have made. You're obviously part of the ownership of this team. I know you're very active, very involved. What do you think is the right move now? Because sometimes you take a young team and you think, let's just let it grow, right? They'll get there. They'll take their incremental steps. They'll two steps forward, one step back, whatever. And then sometimes you need that little push or an injection of new energy. What do you think the answer is this offseason?
Well, I mean, I think when you don't reach your expectations, you can, you know, second guess everything. And, you know, also, in, you know, Tony Ressler, our managing partner, has come out and basically acknowledged some of those same things. And I think the number one thing is, look, you know, sending a message that, you know, we want to win and we want to win a championship. And, you know, getting to the first round and losing is, you know, I don't want to quote Coach K and say unacceptable, but it's, you know, it's not what we want to accomplish. I also know that I think the path to success is not necessarily linear. And we can use Boston as an example. You know, 2 years ago, Boston made it to the conference finals of the bubble. And then last year, I think they lost in the first round to Brooklyn and lost pretty convincingly. And so, you know, they didn't necessarily change the roster. They changed the coach and the general manager, but they kept that core together and maybe didn't overreact and look at where they are now. And so, you know, it's not easy. And as we all know, and I think like anything, after losses as a player, you know, that's when you look in the mirror and say, okay, how can I get better? I think as a franchise and as an organization, after you have a disappointing exit and a disappointing season, at least considering how we finished the year before, you're going to look in the mirror and try to figure out, okay, how can we get better? So I tend to try to frame it as, okay, this is an off season for us to get better and to improve. And what that is, I don't know, but, you know, Travis is on it. He has full support and commitment from Tony and Jamie and ownership. And so we're excited. We've learned about ourselves as a result of this season. We've learned some things that maybe we didn't know last year at this time. And so now, in terms of what to do, is you need cooperation. It's not like things are easy, but, you know, we're in a good place. And I think the standard and the bar has been raised. You know, I used to joke when I was in Phoenix, I talked a lot of trash in practice. And people don't know that. And people, you know, think I'm a trash talker, but I would talk a lot of trash. And, you know, when we would do something good, and, you know, when we're in practice, and let's say the first team were scoring, I would always yell to Nash, Sergei Bubka. And you know, and I'm saying, you know, keep raising the bar, Sergei Bubka, raising the bar, you know, the great pole vaulter back from the 80s. Nash was probably the only one that knew who I was talking about since we were the two old guys on the team. And so, you know, we have a chance. We're raising the bar in terms of what we expect as a franchise and an organization. And what we expect is we want to win. We want to win a championship. So, yeah, there's disappointment, but there's also tremendous opportunity. And I'm looking forward to seeing what we collectively do with Travis and his staff does. And but it's an exciting time for our franchise, and that we get to the playoffs and there's disappointment. And I don't know if that's always been the case historically with the Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah. I want you to start shouting Sergei Bubka at your Hawks team and see how long it takes your very young players to figure this out. And when they do figure it out, that's when they'll know, right? That's the secret, right?
No question. I think he had a clause in his contract. Like every time he set a world record, he got like $500,000 bonus. So he would just go
up,
and he set like 19 world records. And so that's why I always said, raise the bar. Sergei Bubka. And a guy, you know, Jared Dudley is looking at me like, Sergei, what?
I love it. All right. Well, Grant, this has been great. I know you got a bunch of these lined up, so I need to let you go. But folks, the book is Game by Grant Hill. Go check it out. Go find that at all your usual book places, online, in physical stores, all those places. It's great. A lot of really interesting insights into Grant's life and career. Grant, phenomenal. Love seeing you back on the pod. Only three more punch card punches to get your free cup of coffee from the Crossover Pod. And I will see you out in San Francisco.
Hey, I'm already working on my next book, so we can hopefully punch another one here.
There we go. Grant Hill, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Howard.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Grant Hill. Thank you to Colleen McGarvey at Penguin Books for connecting us. And thanks as always to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.